Hey folks, Allie here, host and creator of the Brilliant Body Podcast. And this summer, I recorded a series of conversations with sex experts, and I really wanted to share them with you. You're going to see that they're a lineup. They're going to be pretty much back to back in order to really bring in a variety of perspectives that I suspect will be very helpful to you in many ways, perhaps, because these folks are such experts in their field. Many of them are very well known, and I had the honor of being able to speak with them either because I reached out to them or they reached out to me to be a part of this podcast. So I am thrilled to introduce to you, perhaps for the first time, these sex experts, these body masters, these philosophers, these humans who have so much depth and breadth of experience in the realm of sexuality. So I hope you benefit from these conversations. It was such a pleasure to have them in hopes that they would be a gift to you. So here we go.
The majority of women, upwards of 80% of women, would benefit psychologically, socially, physically, and sexually from being on hormones after menopause if they were done right and individualized for her given circumstance. But we're a long way from 80% when we are only talking about 10-ish percent.
Dr. James A. Simon is a board-certified OBGYN and reproductive endocrinologist. He is clinical professor of obstetrics and gynecology at the George Washington University School of Medicine in Washington, D.C. Dr. Simon also holds certifications as an ASECT-certified sexuality counselor, an ISCD-certified clinical bone densitometrist, and a Menopause Society-certified menopause specialist. He has an active private practice in team medicine specialists in Washington, D.C., focused on complicated gynecology, sexual medicine for both men and women, and menopause. Dr. Simon has received numerous awards, including Top Washington Physicians, America's Top Obstetricians and Gynecologists, Super Doctors of Washington, D.C., Baltimore, Northern Virginia, and the Best Doctors in America. He's the only physician to serve as president of both the Menopause Society and the International Society for the Study of Women's Sexual Health. Nicknamed the Menopause Whisperer by Washingtonian Magazine, Dr. Simon is an established researcher and author, completing more than 800 published articles, abstracts, chapters, and the paperback book, Restore Yourself: A Woman's Guide to Reviving Her Sexual Desire and Passion for Life.
Good morning.
Hi, Jim. Good to see you.
Lovely to see you. How are you?
A lot of things and just came running off the road here. So I'm just going to collect myself for a moment before we get going and before we get into being a menopause whisperer and how to most gracefully navigate menopause, not just for those of us who experience it, but for those who experience people in their lives who are going through it. How is it that a guy who could have just gone and stuck with a very traditional professional life as an increasingly renowned physician with all your accolades and opportunities and success that you have continued to pioneer, not just in the ways you've researched the body and researched women's and men's health, but specifically how our sexual lives interplay with our medical lives? And particularly our hormones, which, in my experience and my understanding of just all I've read, there are a lot of physicians out there who don't even touch people's sexual lives, even though hormones are obviously a cornerstone and a necessity for having fulfilling sexual lives. So, can we start there with how it is that you delved into the world of sexology? As well as being, a renowned traditional physician, you could say, allopathic doctor.
I think it's a good question for sure. And it wasn't a conscious decision, it was more of an evolution. And I think really engages what we all as humans have, childlike curiosity and a desire for novelty. And I think if everyone will just allow themselves to re-experience those two things at least once, my comment will ring very true. I presume some of your audience have grandchildren, for example, or children, where they see the joy that those new lives have in discovering something new or experiencing something for the very first time. And I don't think adults or aging adults are any different. We still can tap into that youthful experience. And so as a clinician and as a clinician scientist, I've always really enjoyed looking for and discovering new things. And that's how I evolve as a person and as a professional over four decades of practice, being drawn by something new, interesting, etc. And then maybe uniquely, as I began to connect a lot of disparate dots, the sexual medicine part of research and education drew me very strongly because it connects the biological, the psychological, and the social all in one arena. And that both presented new opportunities and traditional barriers to helping women particularly and couples.
Isn't it interesting, though, when I listen to you and I'm smiling as I do, that a cardiologist, for example, could also have the opportunity to deal with the sociological, the physical, the psychological, obviously the physical, but the psychological, the cultural. And yet very few physicians, regardless of any particular organ expertise or physical system, don't necessarily delve into those realms. It's common across medicine. And then sex has this whole other opportunity, of course, that's quite an anomaly in the human experience. Would you agree with that? Or would even studying cardiology, if people really delved into people's heart health, their emotional health, their relational health, might be able to open as big a door, but it just seems that sex has its own particular Pandora's box that other organs per se necessarily open us into.
I'd answer the question as if it were two completely distinct questions. So the cardiologist, your example, could very much have a focus in sexual health. Erections in men, arousal in women are vascular events. Mm-hmm. And that cardiologist could open him or herself up to treating sexual dysfunction, or at least the vascular aspects of sexual dysfunction. But in our Western culture, we are often pressured in our professions to seek the most efficient, the most financially reimbursing, and more traditional approaches, because doing other really requires pushing back on a lot of traditional barriers. Mm-hmm. And for myself, I would say that I could have generated a tremendous amount of additional income had I been more on the straight and narrow rather than swerving, dabbling, putting my toe in the water of less reimbursed areas, including social research, which has very poor financial support in any area whatsoever. So that's one thing. And there are a lot of other barriers to trying something new and different, which you and your audience clearly can intuit. It's not difficult.
For sure. We swervers and dabblers are often not remunerated for our adventures and curiosities.
I completely agree with that. And again, going back to my initial comment about childlike behavior interest in novelty and discovery, these are areas that have their own personal reimbursement and psychological reimbursement, but they don't typically have financial reimbursement, at least in Western culture. So that's the one thing I would say. The other is that we tend to be siloed. Psychologists are in one bucket, cardiologists in another bucket, internists in a third bucket, gynecologists in a fourth, whatever. And it's safe and secure and warm and cuddly to stay in your bucket. And it's disquieting and uncomfortable to leave the safe haven of your established bucket. Mm-hmm. So it requires not only a desire for novelty, creativity, et cetera, but guts to do so. And that's the problem with sex in the clinical setting. We don't like to swerve too far out of our comfort zone. Talking about anything sexual is a challenge both for the patient, her partner or his partner, and the practitioner. There are a number of reasons for that. They've been studied. There are lots of data. But I think it boils down to safety, security, efficiency, and money. And all of us, or many of us, have a lot of shame around sexual issues. And we don't want to put our fingers out there or put our head in the noose for potentially opening Pandora's box of questions we don't have answers to, or issues we don't feel comfortable with, etc. So lots of pressures to stay out of the sexual arena, regardless of your background or training.
Yeah, it's amazing because I'm just listening to you and thinking I've never had an OBGYN ever ask me about my relationships or what's going on in my sexual life. In my whole lifetime, I don't think anybody's ever asked me about my heart, for example, emotionally or physically for that matter, when they were helping me with gynecological problems. So your case in point.
So the International Society for the Study of Women's Sexual Health, maturing but relatively longstanding organization, that name says what it is, women's sexual health. We have a number of teachings and suggestions for all disciplines that typically don't touch on sexual health as to how to open the conversation in a non-threatening way. I'll give you an example that focuses on menopause and perimenopause. It might be a ubiquitous statement with an open-ended question. For example, talking to a 50-year-old woman, one might say, women your age commonly have changes in their bodies related to menopause, which can spill over to sexual problems. Does that sound familiar? Or something like that, which allows the conversation to proceed from her point of view and go in whatever direction is necessary. I personally have taken a completely different approach that at least seems to work for me. And that is, every time I see a patient, every time I ask about her breast health, her bowels, her bladder, and her sex life, in that order, matter-of-factly, Ellie, how are your breasts, bowels, bladder, and sex life? And just let her pick what's important to her at that visit to bring up. And then, not uncommonly, and this may seem like a baiting and switching, but it's a practical approach, she might say, or you might say, ever since menopause, or ever since I broke up with my boyfriend, or ever since blah, 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 I've really been struggling with whatever. And then I'll come back and say, this is a really important subject for us to discuss in depth. I make it my problem. I haven't planned for an in-depth discussion of that issue today. You're here just for your annual exam or your pap smear. Let's get together and really dig into this. It's important to you. It's important to me. Go talk to my scheduling person and let's schedule an hour to sit down and dig deep into this issue.
So I assume that means you do actually sit down with your patient, not in a gown on the table, but you actually sit in an office and then have that conversation?
Yes. So two things. First, as a male gynecologist, I need to be very sensitive to the male-female barriers and issues of one's body and body integrity, etc. So when I meet a patient for the first time, I always see her fully dressed in my office and talk about why she's there, even if she's there just to establish routine gynecologic care, and she's healthy. She's 30 years old, not thinking of getting pregnant, not sexually active, whatever it is, just needs an exam or a refill on birth control pills or something. I see her fully clothed. We have a discussion in my office. Then I'll ask her to go to an exam room, get undressed, and do her exam. Same story for subjects that are not related to a particular procedure or activity, as we've just been discussing, related to sexual function, et cetera. Could be infertility. It might be another good example where I want a deeper understanding of what's going on. I might ask her to bring her partner or her husband or whoever's involved in either the fertility arena or in the concept of sexual function. And sometimes I get more than I bargained for. So I might ask her to bring her sexual partner and she comes with two different people. This is not in our typical heterosexual dyad, but the answer is, okay, we'll work through it, talk about it, who's who, blah, blah, blah. But everybody's got their clothes on and it's a nice, safe, quiet space in my office.
Does anybody ever say to you when you ask them about their sexual health or their life or their issues, none of your business, buddy, or in giving them the smorgasbord of those four different arenas or organs or areas that circumvents anybody feeling invaded in any way or put on the spot?
I haven't had a hard pushback in the way you presented it. I just have not. That might be luck. I don't know. I have had patients say, I'm not ready to talk about it. I've had patients say that I'm seeing someone else about it, or that's my personal bridge to cross, and if I need help, I'll come back and circle back or something. But not, it's none of your business. I've not had that really ever. And it's perhaps because of other things that I do in the process. So let's say someone's in the exam room for their routine exam, and just like everybody else, breast, bowels, bladder, sex, I'm asking that question not with her up in the stirrup, not with my standing at the side of the bed or the side of the exam table looking down at her, but I always, and this is the power dynamic issue in extremis, I'll be sitting on a stool as if I were going to do her exam, but off to the side of the exam table where she is sitting above me and therefore in the power dynamic that she's in control. She is physically above me looking down at me. This is all conscious. And I think it allows for that question to be received in a more open way, one where she's in control to open up or not.
Yeah, it's a bit of personal geometry in there. The spatial relationship we feel profoundly is just as animal beings, all the meaning within that. I love how you're using that so conscientiously. It's beautiful. My guess too, Jim, is that you have such a particular way, and it's been slowing me down, of speaking and enunciating, and your nervous system feels very regulated because you're a slower pace than a lot of people. it slows people into their own parasympathetic, so they're less likely to feel threatened in any kind of way.
Yeah, that is also partially conscious and partially learned. One of the things that have slowed me down, probably unconsciously over the decades, but then became part of my being, was dealing, as I have in Washington, D.C., with many people whose first language is not English. And so you need to speak more slowly. You need to enunciate more clearly. And that allows anyone, whether it's English is their first language or not, to process what you're saying and think about it as it's coming out. And I found that to be very helpful. Again, in our rush world of 24/7 activity, it's a little atypical. It's not the best business model, but the answer is I think it gets one to the end in a better way. It may be the tortoise and the hare analogy is a good thing. Slow and steady wins the race or something like that.
So this moniker of being the menopause whisperer, I imagine, has a lot to do with your social and emotional perceptivity, as well as your medical expertise. How did you come to that moniker, or was that put on you or given to you, or tell us about that?
Yeah, so it was totally serendipitous. I was asked to do an interview, I think it was probably around 10 years ago, with a disgruntled patient, not of mine, but a disgruntled patient of another practitioner who also happened to work for Washingtonian Magazine. And she wanted to do an interview about perimenopause and menopause and me and how I saw the field evolving and growing. Remember, this was 10 years ago. And so we had a nice, long face-to-face interview. She took notes on a legal pad with a pen. And she said something toward the end of that, "Would you object if I called you the menopause whisperer?" And I said, "Hell no, why not?" And that she put it actually in her article in Washingtonian. So I came to it by virtue of a reporter for Washingtonian Magazine.
And what makes you uniquely qualified for this fantastic title?
I think there are a few things that are unique. I don't know that they make me uniquely qualified, but I did a couple of things along the way that opened my eyes to these biological, psychological, and social approaches to care, not only menopause care and sexual medicine care, but to health care generally. And the ones I would pick out are a rotation that I took upon myself, having a free quarter at the end of medical school and knowing that I wanted to do obstetrics and gynecology as a profession, I sought out an opportunity to learn about sex and sexual dysfunction from the late Domina Renshaw, R-E-N-S-H-A-W. Dr. Renshaw is a South African physician, psychiatrist at Loyola University of Chicago at that time, who, think about the context, started the first sexual medicine training at a Catholic university hospital in suburban Chicago. Now, those words should trigger all kinds of thought processes. But she did it, was very successful for many generations, and I sought out the idea of training with her for a period of time and seeing patients with her as part of that training. Now, Dr. Renshaw at the time was a world authority on sexual function and dysfunction in children of incest. There's a group of individuals, men and women, who have been molested by a parent, who are more challenging in the sexual function and dysfunction arena. I do not know of one. They are really tough. And she was amazing. And that experience was life-changing for me in my thought processes, both about sexual issues, but also about social issues and our growth and development as children, that was really important in my professional evolution. The other part of it that was amazing, just absolutely amazing, was this was training in the typical Masters and Johnson approach, where there was a male therapist and a female therapist, and people met with the same sex person, the opposite sex person, the couples together, the couples separately, etc. Lots of mixing and matching. So everyone had a co-therapist in this training program. And I happened to be the extra male. And so she, Dr. Renshaw, volunteered to be my co-therapist. So I got to do training and therapy with these couples, with the boss, so to speak. And that was a really amazing experience, because she had done it all, seen it all, and was just a tremendous asset to my learning.
Sounds amazing. So your whispering, aka attunement, shall we say, is very contextual. That's what I'm hearing, is that she really taught you a lot about how medicine is contextual as this whole being, which of course holistic health has been talking about for a really long time. So what is it that we get so wrong in our culture, or just even amongst your colleagues, when it comes to menopause? And what do we need to know, particularly, that from your really in-depth perspective is so missed?
Allie, I think that's a very complicated question.
Yeah.
I'll give you my perspective. The first is that we all come to training in advanced training in school with a whole bunch of our own baggage, whether it's personal, from our own psychosexual development, schooling, our relationships as they've evolved from teenage years, etc. So lots of baggage, and many individuals, men and women, do not want to go there. It's painful. It's challenging. It's just hard. And so going back and digging into those things as strengths, even if they're negative in your life, but using them as a pillar of strength to even possibly address similar issues in a woman or a man who's coming to you for help, that requires big, deep breaths, lots of relaxation, and distancing oneself from one's own feelings about their experience and being receptive and thoughtful about the person you're talking to in front of you. So that's a huge barrier that we all have, and you can't get away from. Learning how to dig into those things, I don't know how that happened to me or did happen to me, but I think my training in sexual medicine with Dr. Renshaw certainly helped me understand myself and my own background and how I could bring it as a strength, not a weakness. The other is the more formal aspects of training, and specifically as related to menopause and not psychological or personal development. It has been long neglected in formal medical training. Physicians in obstetrics and gynecology, not even talking about your cardiologist example, but in obstetrics and gynecology, and there are several studies on this, get 1 hour of their entire four-year residency on menopause. And that's not me talking. That's actual scientific information.
Does this come down to misogyny ultimately? I hate to be so crass and reductive, but my God, at some point I'm getting flared up. It's just offensive.
I think it might have been in the past. I'm reminded of something my grandfather, a very prestigious physician in his day, told my mother when she said she wanted to go to medical school, and he was strongly dissuading of her because of the way the medical profession and the medical training treated women at the time. And so he, in his desire to protect his own daughter from those behaviors, misogyny and patrimony, for example, dissuaded her. I think ultimately that was a mistake as the world evolved, but it certainly was a clear event in her life. I think now it's more an issue of this is the way we've always done it, as opposed to being a conscious misogynistic or patriarchal issue. In the past, I do think, for good reason actually, that menopause and aging women were disenfranchised, discounted, and devalued. And that applies to aging men also. In the past, women and men age 50 were not nearly as healthy as we are now. Life expectancy was shorter. And to think, for example, that a 50-year-old woman was a sexual being when she was really quite ill and unable to even do daily activities is acceptable to me in a retrospective point of view than the way I see my patients now, who are 50 and vital and look amazing and are strong and work a full-time job and are mothers, and some of them are grandmothers, and et cetera, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. And they are spectacular in their abilities. And if they have a sexual problem, the underlying issues are very different than chronic fatigue and disease, et cetera. And so times are evolving, but I don't think our education has evolved. And sex, particularly, and menopause have been subjugated to other avenues of development in the discipline that need to be forced into the curriculum, further limiting time. I don't agree with that, but that's, I think, the way it is. As it relates to patrimony or a patriarchal system, most of the individuals in obstetrics and gynecology, even in positions of authority now, contemporary, are women. Hard to blame them for the sins of the past, but hopefully entreat them to improve things in the future.
So I have to say, when I ran into some hormonal issues, and maybe we'll get into that when we start actually talking about hormones, I had 4 different female doctors on numerous occasions all try to get me to have a hysterectomy. And every one of them said verbatim, but you don't need it anymore. And I thought, if that is not a trickle down or an embodiment of patriarchal view, that an aspect of my body isn't who I am, for one thing, which of course is a lot of what this podcast is about, is that the amount of history, difficult and wondrous, that is a part of my uterus and who I am, let alone the architectural changes that having an organ gone and the surgical trauma and the rearrangement of organs and connective tissue and how it changes the pressure in my whole body and all the complications that could happen, to be so glib about that, particularly as women physicians, was deeply shocking and discouraging to me. And if I had been a less stubborn person and a less knowledgeable person and a less body-oriented person, I would have succumbed like millions of other women have. And I don't know a lot of women who have had just hysterectomies that weren't necessary be glad that they'd done it. So I hope things are evolving. And yet at the same time, these were young women. What do you think about that?
So I think your experience is not unique.
No.
I also think that the pendulum is swinging in a variety of different directions on that specific subject. First, historically, and I'm not sure how many years ago, but certainly when I was in training, which was some time ago now, the indications for a hysterectomy were, let's say, almost having a uterus. That was the indication for hysterectomy.
Yeah.
And I fully understand how that could be an offensive comment, and I don't mean to be offensive. But for me personally, it was an opportunity because I learned to do a hysterectomy a lot of times and by a lot of different surgeons and by a lot of different techniques, which made me a great surgeon. Not because I'm inherently a great surgeon, but just by experience. Might have been unindicated experience. It might have been way over treatment experience. It might have been ways that practitioners were trying to enrich themselves experience, but I got the experience. And unfortunately, these days, many of the practitioners in obstetrics and gynecology now have too little experience, which may be part of their desire to do more hysterectomies. And so we used to do too many, for sure. Then we went through a period where I believe we did too few, and women had lots of pain and suffering that would have been eliminated had they had a hysterectomy. And now we're settling back somewhere in the middle, probably a much more appropriate place where a combination of the payers, the insurance companies, don't want to pay out the money, and they're putting pressure to do fewer, and there's an equilibrium being established. But your experience, I don't think, is unique, but that's where we are on that subject. And I do agree with you. If it's unnecessary, just don't do it. One of the things that I've evolved as an expert on is how to help women avoid hysterectomy by manipulating their hormone.
Yes.
Recognize that the number one reason for hysterectomy is abnormal bleeding, usually in the perimenopause, mainly women, say, 45 to 50. And if you can control the bleeding and get them over the hump so that now they're menopausal, most of the time the causes of their bleeding, not all, but most of the time the causes of their bleeding go away and they can avoid the surgery and still go on to use hormones and get standard treatment after menopause. And further to that, we have a lot more tools, both minor surgical tools and hormonal tools, to accomplish that end.
Yeah, in my case, it wasn't because of bleeding. It was just because of thickening of the lining, because I had taken myself off of progesterone because I became suspicious that it was causing depression and difficulty that I have heard since that, what is it, 10 or 20% of the population is highly progesterone sensitive. So I took myself off it for too long and my lining thickened too much and became, went into hyperplasia.
Plastic, yeah.
Plastic, there you go. And I was able to reverse it through hormones and diet and other things, which I'm very grateful about. But will you talk about this about HRT in general, because I just heard a statistic this morning, actually, that only 4% of women are on hormone replacement therapy, which I found was shocking. I don't know if that checks out with your data, but I am amazed by that. I don't think I'd be alive if I weren't on it. So just curious your view on HRT. Obviously, you're an expert in it, so I assume you think it's highly valuable. But why are people so afraid of it? And what is your experience with it?
So this, too, is a very long conversation.
I know. And we have so many other things to talk about, too.
Let's dive in a little bit. So first of all, both men and women have hormones. The hormones in both men and women are largely related to reproduction in their most base level. Reproduction is related to sex. So now we're fully back to the original story. As women lose their reproductive potential, that is to say, their eggs are older, their menstrual cycles are more irregular or absent fertile ovulations, the hormones that are produced in the ovaries are likewise altered. That's what we call the perimenopause. And it's not that women in perimenopause don't make hormones, but they make them sporadically, and they make them both in excess and not enough. And so I liken this to mountains. I know that sounds weird, but imagine this. A woman's hormones during her reproductive life are like the nice, gentle Appalachian mountains. They're rolling hills. Every month they ebb and they flow, and menstrual cycles happen, babies get made, etc. But there are no Grand Tetons. There are no dramatic ups and downs. They're more rolling hills meant for reproduction, and sex is tied to reproduction. And actually, we can talk about this, tied to those hormonal shifts. But in the perimenopause, because the eggs that are left in a woman's ovaries are resistant to both ovulation and to making hormones, the body, in trying to recap those nice rolling hills of younger age, they overshoot and undershoot the levels, the body trying desperately to eke out the last few menstrual cycles in a relatively normal way, which turn out to be abnormal. The hormones are too high and then fall, and there's too much hormone and therefore too much uterine lining and heavy bleeding, leading, as we discussed, to hysterectomy and abnormal bleeding. And then there are periods of time in that same woman when her hormones are so low that she has menopause-like symptoms, hot flashes, night sweats, vaginal dryness, pain with sex, etc. And sometimes from 1 month to the next, she may have one set of symptoms followed by the other set of symptoms. It's a real roller coaster up and down those Grand Tetons. And that gives that woman changes, both biological and psychological, that she's never experienced before. For example, migraine headaches from the rapid rises and falls in estrogen or mood changes, from being withdrawn in the same way drug addicts are withdrawn from their natural hormonal milieu to one where they're menopausal all of a sudden, and their bodies are clearly not ready for that change. And so this roller coaster of up and downs is what really affects women, their intimate partners, their families, their work environment. These are all extremely well documented. As it relates to your comment about fear of and lack of use of hormone therapy, here are some statistics. And I stand by these. They're not my numbers, but they're well published. approximately 2001, around 40% of menopausal women, 40, were using hormone therapy. These were menopausal women, not perimenopausal. But 40% of women who are menopausal chose to use hormone therapy for their symptoms, for their sex lives, for bone preservation, and the presumption of preservation of youth and health. Shortly after that time, in July of 2002, a very important study, the Women's Health Initiative Hormone Studies, were published to great fanfare. And I want to say the studies were extremely well planned and extremely well done, but I would argue poorly interpreted and poorly publicized, emphasizing the risks of hormone therapy rather than the benefits of hormone therapy. And that was, in my opinion, an overgeneralization of the results, having to do with the inclusion of many, many much older women in the studies, including women 79 years of age at the beginning and into their 80s at the end of the study. So huge numbers of women in 2002, hearing about all these risks of this very important, large, expensive NIH-sponsored study, went off their hormones to great fanfare and with some degree of consequence in those women who went off their hormones in terms of side effects, increased bone loss, fractures, heart attacks, strokes, all kinds of things, loss of employment, etc., that we would now consider very negative. It hasn't come back. So the current utilization of hormones has come up a little in the last 5 to 10 years, but it's still somewhere between 5 and 10% of menopausal women, which obviously is nowhere near 40%. And I would argue my personal opinion that the majority of women, upwards of 80% of women, would benefit psychologically, socially, physically, and sexually from being on hormones after menopause if they were done right and individualized for her given circumstance. But we're a long way from 80% when we were only talking about 10-ish percent.
I thought, too, that some of it had to do with the source of the hormone coming from pregnant horses or something, right? And so the product had some flaw in it as well, or a greater risk to it.
There's an element of truth in your comment, and then there are some hidden silver lining. So the market leader in estrogen treatment back in the 2000s was a medication called Premarin, P-R-E-M-A-R-I-N. And Premarin was a contraction of pregnant mare's urine. Yeah. Because, as you noted, the primary source of the estrogen was the urine of pregnant horses. And that product had been on the market for decades, was the market leader at the time the study was designed in the early 1990s, and it was the sole product used in that large study, either alone in women who had a hysterectomy and who did not require progesterone, or with a synthetic form of progesterone in women who had a uterus and needed to use some form of progesterone to prevent endometrial hyperplasia or thickening of the uterine lining. Well, the results of those studies were very scary and negative. Part of that is likely related to the fact that this specific hormone in Premarin, which is not one thing, it's actually pregnant mares make a lot of different hormones, and all of them end up in the product, may have some unique properties, both good and bad, that show out in these results. For example, because it had been around for a long time, we had tons of data on it. That's a good thing. Data is a good thing. We also knew that in women who started the product early in their menopause, they appeared to live longer, healthier lives. And that was one of the reasons that the study was done, to prove it in a randomized, placebo-controlled approach. But it's a very potent group of hormones, unique to horses, but given to women. And that could be good or bad. It was certainly good for their bones. It might have been particularly bad for blood clots and deep vein thrombosis, etc. And some of those differences have come to light since 2002 when the results came. There have been a number of reasons that women stopped using oral estrogens and oral Premarin and Premarin-like products based on this study. Some of their reasons are good, some of their reasons are not, but the answer is there's been a rapid change from oral estrogens to non-oral estrogens like patches and transdermal gels and vaginal rape. One of the interesting issues is that, oh, about 10 years ago, we helped to develop an oral product of natural estrogen and estradiol and natural progesterone that bypassed all the adverse effects that were seen with Premarin or its first cousin in those studies. But the negative press about oral estrogens globally and the labeling of estrogens generally in the United States with all the risks have really undermined the success of that very unique product. But the answer is women have choices, whether it's this unique oral product or patches or vaginal rings or transdermal gels. There are options, and they're not all created equal. And they're not all equally acceptable to an individual. So I like the fact that women have choices, but they have to be given the choices.
Yeah, and they have to be able to afford them as well, because hormone care is expensive unless you have some kind of magical insurance, for sure. Can your product be taken sublingually?
No, it's meant to be taken orally. It's not my product. I helped to develop it with one company, and then they sold it to another. But the unique characteristics of it were, like many things in medicine, discovered by total serendipity. Let me give you an example. Viagra, an erectile dysfunction drug for men, was developed for high blood pressure. And in the course of studies taking it for high blood pressure, and while it did lower blood pressure, those older men with high blood pressure had better erection. And somebody looking at the data said, we got lots of other blood pressure medicines, but we don't have anything for these men with erectile dysfunction. Let's take a closer look. In this particular case, the goal was to develop an oral product because most people find orals to be less expensive and easier to use than patches, gels, vaginal rings, etc. And so the goal was to develop an oral product that had both natural estrogen and natural progesterone in the same product so that a woman could take one pill a day and be done. And that was accomplished with some difficulty because the amount of estrogen needed in a woman is very low. The amount of progesterone needed is relatively high compared to the estrogen. And getting them both in the body in the proper amounts turns out not to be so easy. Well, in the process of getting it into the body in the proper amounts without having the liver digest the products or be adversely affected by the products took a lot of creativity. And it turned out that the product was able to get into the body without affecting the liver as if it went through the vagina or the skin. And so it's an oral combination estrogen and progesterone product that metabolically behaves more like a gel or a vaginal ring or a patch. And that's serendipity.
Well, you're hopefully just ahead of your time rather than it's too late on something like that. Because, I mean, look, menopause seems to be having some sort of a moment, hopefully forever, you know, where Halle Berry and Kate Winslet and these beautiful celebrities are coming forward and speaking about it in a very unabashed way, thank goodness. So hopefully more people, including our listeners, will explore the opportunity of it, because if this comes off like an infomercial, that's okay with me because it changed my life and I would be non-functional without HRT. I'd love for you to talk a bit too about testosterone and the importance of it for women's health as well as men's health, because people tend to think or even cringe at the thought of women having a significant amount of testosterone in a natural balance until they lose it. It doesn't mean that it turns us into men or hairy monsters. So would you talk about that and how important it is for sexual health and just psychological well-being?
So let's start out with a few facts. Women make lots of testosterone all of their reproductive lives, probably on average 10 times more testosterone than estrogen. I'm going to say that one more time because I want to make sure no one misheard what I said. Women make about 10-fold more testosterone every day of their reproductive lives than they make estrogen. That's a lot of testosterone. It certainly means that it's a woman's hormone, not just a men's hormone. And so that's a big barrier for many women to get over, but they need to get over it because testosterone is critical all of a woman's younger life for a number of functions, including sexual desire, which most women know. They don't know it as a fact, but they know it instinctively. So most of reproductive aged women notice or sense an increase in spontaneous sexual thoughts, fantasies, etc., when they're having their menstrual cycle, right at ovulation where their testosterone is peaking, their estrogen is peaking, they're about to ovulate, they're most fertile, and Mother Nature is saying, get down, get pregnant, and make a baby. That's what Mother Nature is saying, and she's doing it to their brains with her hormones. I know that's crass, but that's true. So women make a lot of testosterone all of their reproductive lives. Their testosterone does not just go away at menopause unless they've had their ovaries removed at that time. It slowly dwindles down from a time of peaking in their late 20s to around age 60, where it becomes unmeasurable. It doesn't just take a big nosedive at menopause the way estrogen does. It slowly and progressively goes down with consequences. Some of those consequences are a decrease in sexual desire, sexual thoughts, sexual fantasies, but also a decrease in lean muscle, a decrease in strength, and a decrease in bone density, to name just a few things.
Yeah, I even heard that it really affects your bladder, your urethral health, because it's receptive to testosterone. And so incontinence can be a direct result of decreased testosterone.
So I think it's a little more complicated than that, but I would agree that it's true. For example, because testosterone affects all the muscles, remember I said decreased testosterone, decreased muscle mass? Recognize that our pelvic floor muscles, which are incredibly important to both sexual function and continence of urine, continence of stool. All of these muscles are affected, and aging likewise affects all of those areas. Recognize that as an upright, two-footed primate, as opposed to a four-footed primate, gravity is not our friend either. So everything falls down with gravity as we age, and if our muscles can't hold it up because they are adversely affected by hormones, age, weakness, nervous changes, etc., drugs, then we lose it, and that could be losing urine, losing gas, losing fecal continence, etc. So all of these synergize as we age, and in women, they synergize with hormonal changes at menopause, recognizing, and this is important, there's a very delicate interplay between estrogen, which does tank at menopause, and testosterone receptors, which are critical to testosterone action. Estrogen increases the sensitivity of testosterone receptors to whatever testosterone is around at the time. So there's a big complicated interplay, but in general, number one fact, women make bucket loads of testosterone compared to estrogen. Testosterone goes down slowly from late 20s to menopause, disappearing from its ability to be measured by age 60 in women. And so giving testosterone back to women, beginning somewhere in the late 40s or at menopause, seems totally reasonable if we're going to give them estrogen or other hormones for whatever reasons. Now, testosterone has been largely studied in women for sex, for sexual interest and the downstream effects of interest on arousal, orgasm, general sexual function, psychological mood around sex, etc. But that doesn't mean it doesn't do all the other things that I've alluded to. It does. They've just been, I would say, inadequately studied. I'll give you an example. Many women in the perimenopause and menopause complain of dry eye. Their eyes are dry, their skin is dry, their vaginas are dry, everything's dry, their hair is dry. They go from using makeup to requiring using moisturizer every night. If they don't, they feel like a desert has taken over their skin. But this is also hormonal. Let's give you an example. Every young boy or girl, when they go through puberty, they get oily skin, some get acne. That's the impact of androgens on their skin, or testosterone and other adrenal androgens on their skin. The exact opposite happens at the time of menopause, when the skin becomes drier because they don't have that oily substance they used to make all their life associated with their menstrual hormones or their adrenal androgens. If you give them their testosterone after menopause, you can reduce or eliminate their moisturizer habit just by having their own skin make its own moisture again. The problem worldwide has been that there are no testosterone products specifically developed and dosed for women. And men have 10 times as much testosterone as women do, and so use of a male product in women is likely to result in balding and bearding and other masculinizing side effects that are universally not acceptable in women. And what we really need is a product or products, so women have choices, that are focused on giving testosterone to women. And there is some development in that area going on as we speak.
So are the molecules of testosterone in a male body, a cisgender male body, as opposed to a cisgender female body, actually different, or is it just the dose that is different?
Yeah, so it's exactly the same chemical compound. Testosterone is testosterone is testosterone, just present in different amounts and secreted in different patterns. For example, in men, testosterone is secreted by the testicle pretty constantly from puberty until death, although in decreasing amounts. Every day, about the same amount, but slowly decreasing with age. In women, it's secreted by the ovary and the adrenal glands, as in men. But in women, it's secreted in an episodic way, peaking and troughing at different times of her menstrual cycle. And then after menopause, secreted more like it is in men, but at a much lower level.
That's so interesting how cyclical the female body is by nature and how, in contrast to this consistent way of the male body producing.
Very different, but neither good nor bad. It's just the way it is.
Yeah.
And its basis and its barest minimum, it's all about reproduction.
Yeah.
It's all about reproduction. The males were meant to be reproductively competent all the time. Any receptive female in the area was subject to mating.
Gotta be ready.
Gotta be ready. And in other species, it's multiple females. So that male primate, baboon, monkey, etc., if he is the dominant male, he may have 6, 8, 10 females that are his for the taking, so to speak, whereas our dyadic approach to mating and reproduction in humans is obviously very different.
Yeah. Oh, my God. So many things I could ask about there. But since we're coming towards the end of this time, I just want to loop back around to a couple of things, one of which was just the power of hormones in their minute quantities. Is there anything else like that in the human body that has such potency in such small amounts? And anything you want to say about that? Because I find it just phenomenal when you hear about pheromones being, not just in humans, but in moths, for example, just being able to blast out signals for vast distances. It astounds me.
Yeah, so this is actually a fascinating question. I'm going to take us down a rabbit hole, but we're not going to go very deep. I would also argue that some of our brain hormones are equally potent in driving a number of different effects. And I'll give an example. These days, the injectable weight loss drugs.
I was going to ask you about those.
Mm-hmm. The injectable weight loss drugs, the GLP-1 receptor agonists mimic very important hormonal axis in the body that affects much more than just weight loss or diabetes control. We know, for example, that these drugs, as effective as they are for reducing appetite for food, reducing diabetes, causing weight loss, which can be extremely healthy, also can reduce addictive behavior for alcohol, cannabis, cocaine, opiates, etc. And they are incredibly powerful in the brain and in the body for a variety of different aspects, biological, psychological, and social. So I would focus there, and that's about metabolic effects, and insulin and diabetes are incredibly important, potent, because we need energy, and we need energy for everything, including reproduction. And so these are all connected together in much the same way we've been talking about hormones. So that's what I would say. I don't want to go down that rabbit hole. It's very complicated. I would also say looking at the psychological and social, our brains as humans are incredibly powerful. And I don't wish to discount our needs or our desires, which are in some ways hormonally modulated, but they're always there as a critical aspect, equally important to our hormones, into what we do, how we do it, what we want, what we don't want, etc. And so I know your audience has a number of individuals that are interested in the psychosocial aspect of our lives, and I don't want to discount that at all. They are critical. Some of them are changeable. Some of them may not be from childhood, etc. Important, critical. Let's not forget them.
Love it. I felt, Jim, like this has been just a mere sampler plate of a huge array of topics that I would love to delve into at more length. I hope we'll get another chance to do that, because each one of these things we've talked about, we could go into a lot more. I would love to. And I have a whole series of other questions that we didn't get to. And the other loop I wanted to come back to, and maybe we'll do this next time around if I'm so fortunate, is you mentioned this thing about how our age at 50 now is very different than 50 years ago, for example, and how 50-year-old or middle-aged women haven't been viewed as sexual beings. I would go so far as to say it's quite recent that even 20 or 30-year-olds have been viewed as sexual beings in and of themselves, as opposed to just the inspiration, shall we say, of men's sexual beingness. So I just wanted to come back to that at some point too, about how menopause can really affect our own sense of sexuality and how it gives us an opportunity, certainly in my own experience, of evolving a sense of sexuality and wholeness. And I'd love to get more of your perspective even on just that before I have to let you go.
Well, let me just add that I'd love to come back and talk to you about it. But let's not forget that historically, women's sexual, at least, interest and behavior was restrained because they had no contraception in the past. And so an act of sex at a time when she was most interested and most fertile biologically had to be balanced with the fact that single act of heterosexual intercourse could result in a pregnancy with all of the biological, psychological, social, and financial constraints of a pregnancy, which are huge in humans, much less in other animals, by the way. Since the advent of safe and effective contraception, something I marched for in the late 60s, women have been let loose, if you will, or less restrained as it relates to the burdens of unintended pregnancy, and has allowed them on some level to behave sexually in a way that's consistent with what they feel inside. And that has changed the sexual dynamic for all people in a way that I think is more positive, constructive, and on its base, more natural. And I think that continues to evolve societally in a very important way. Hopefully we can get rid of some of the shame and restraints that we learn as we grow and develop from childhood and really get to see each other as positive sexual beings going forward.
I love it. And thank goodness there's at least one doctor out there who's holding down that fort and really encouraging your patients and all that you come in contact with to be all the more open to a whole new landscape of what it is to be an aging sexual being. And I so appreciate that and really look forward to continuing that topic because, of course, as our bodies change and there can be a lot of weight gain or just changes to our bodies, it can become, I know for myself, like almost this experience of dysmorphia as we age. and not recognizing who we are as external beings. And yet, as you say, internally, we're having perhaps a very different experience that hopefully, as we stay within our own subjective right to who we are, we can continue to fulfill ourselves in this congruent kind of way. So thank you for inspiring me, Jim, and for, I'm sure, inspiring our audience today. And I look forward to part two whenever we're able to make that happen.
I look forward to part two as we go forward and hope you and your listeners have a wonderful day.
Thanks so much. Until next time, then.
It's really a pleasure, Ali.
Thanks so much for being with us. We hope you enjoyed today's episode. And we'd be so grateful if you could share it with a friend, leave a review, and rate the podcast. This really does help us reach more people in our mission to expand the global understanding, experience, and celebration of body brilliance. And just so you know, our events and content remain free in our effort to expand the meaning of intelligence, but we do gratefully accept donations to help with our operating costs. So if you have a bit extra and feel so inspired, you can find the link to support us in the show notes. And while you're there, check out all the resources we've included to help you dive deeper into today's topics. You can also visit www.thebrilliantbodypodcast.com for a complete list of episodes, body meditations, and many more brilliant things. And if you're curious to explore how I work with clients and students to reclaim body brilliance, visit my website at www.alimezey.com. And lastly, a huge hearty thank you to my co-producer and co-editor, the brilliant Florence Popoff, and to Blair, Mr. One Man Band Wilson, for our theme music. Until next time, stay curious, stay connected, stay loving, and reclaim your brilliant body.